Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Zach Smerin
and Ben Yanowitz. For this episode, we interviewed Yella and Tori, two organizers of Oy Vey, an outward-facing, inclusive, and unapologetically Jewish hub in Amsterdam. They initiated the creation of a new Jewish manifesto.
Like the Declaration of Independence of Diaspora, the New Jewish Manifesto was created in dialogue with the progressive Jewish movement in the Netherlands, alongside input from hundreds of members of the wider Dutch Jewish community, to articulate their vision of a Jewish future bound to the liberation of all humanity. While we got an exclusive sneak peek of the manifesto in the interview, the full text will be released on November the 21st.
This interview was recorded at the end of October, before both the U.S. presidential election and the events connected to the game between Ajax Amsterdam and Maccabi Tel Aviv.
We agree with the analysis that Yella, one of today's guests, went on to make after the violence unfolded. Two things can be true at the same time. And unlike Ajax versus Maccabi, politics is not a football match, with only two teams on the pitch. There's a whole spectrum of groups and perspectives with internal divisions and many positions. Opposition to Israeli fascist hooligans is not opposition to Jews as a whole. Likewise, the attacks that occurred in response to Maccabi hooligans, which did not differentiate between the different Maccabi fans or Israelis in Amsterdam, and repeatedly used anti-Semitic slurs, were essentialist, immoral, and counterproductive to the struggle for Palestinian liberation.
As Diaspora Alliance organizer and Na'amod co-founder M. Hilton emphasized, we need to be able to distinguish between anti-Semitism / anti-Jewish racism and anti-Israel hostility / xenophobia et al. Without this, we are only furthering a far-right agenda who are using these horrific times to push their own anti-migrant, xenophobic, racist agenda and have zero interest in real Jewish concerns about rising anti-Semitism or how to support minority communities. It's important to not frame this as some inherently anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish pogrom, precisely because it will only inflame anti-Semitic attitudes and ideas. Framing it this way only creates further skepticism as to whether anti-Semitism is real or if it's just a tool to deflect any kind of criticism of Israel.
We'd also like to acknowledge the unfortunate outcome of the US election. Clearly, we are in a moment of far-right ascendancy. With all the feelings this leads to, it's important to remember we can't just mourn. We have to organize our communities and movements to build the alternatives we need.
Thank you so much to all of our audience and supporters. If you like what we do here and want to support Grassroots Diasporist Media, please leave us a rating on your podcast platform of choice. Consider supporting us on Patreon, follow us on Instagram, and share our content with your communities. It's critical that we reach as wide an audience as possible, and your help allows us to keep creating this podcast.
With all that out of the way, we hope you enjoy the conversation.
They will not divide us. We will not abide this. We know that together we'll be free.
Tori and Yella, it's great to have you here. Would you just like to start off with speaking a little bit about yourselves, your background, and how you got to be where you are?
You go first, Yella.
Okay.
That gives me time to think.
Okay. So my name is Yella. I'm from Amsterdam originally. I was raised in a, I would say, typically Dutch family. I only discovered that I had a Jewish background when I was around the age of 12. And that's when I became super obsessed with Judaism and with, you know, Jewish identity. And yeah, I decided to convert to Judaism when I was around 20, 21. Been involved in the Jewish community. Besides my work as a theater maker, I also work for Greenpeace. So I'm an activist, change maker, and one of the people behind Oy Vey, which we will also be speaking about today, I'm guessing.
I'm Tori Eggerman. I come from a small town Jewish background. My grandparents were born in shtetls and moved to the U.S. when they were children and moved to small towns in the U.S. So I like to say I'm a small town Jew, born of small town Jews. And then I moved to Amsterdam a little more than 20 years ago. And what's interesting to me is that I kind of reconnected with my Jewishness. I never disconnected from my Jewishness, but from the religious side, was at a Pride Shabbat that Yella was the cantor at. And it was so great. I was so excited. And actually, that was the high point of my Jewish religious experience in the Netherlands.
Did we know each other back then, Jordan?
No, we didn't know each other. So it's really funny.
Wow. How long ago was that?
How long ago was that, Yella? Do you know? It was before the COVID lockdown. So maybe a couple years before.
That's about when I quit being a cantor. So I would say, 2019, something like that.
So Tori, you were born in the United States and then you moved to Amsterdam. What was it about that specific place that drew you to want to immigrate there?
I guess love and work. You know, Amsterdam has a way of kind of connecting with you, like drawing you in, even though it hasn't been an easy move for me. It hasn't been an easy transition. I don't really gel with Dutch culture or typical Dutch culture, but with atypical Dutch culture, I'm fine. It hasn't been smooth for me, but I do love living here.
Could you say what you mean by that? Like typical Dutch culture versus atypical Dutch culture?
Well, I mean, there's some things that I notice in Dutch culture that are different from what I am used to. Let's just say, like, and I guess that I am really used to being around probably more people with ADHD. Maybe that's what I mean. Like, I think that American culture is just more friendly to it, so friendly to it that you don't notice you have it until you move to the Netherlands, where things are so linear and people speak one at a time. Yella knows what a problem I have speaking one at a time. It's like a huge problem for me. I don't think of myself as having a disorganized mind. I think my mind is very organized, but for Dutch people, it feels really disorganized. That has been a real wake-up call for me. Like, it's taken me a really long time to figure these things out, though. I didn't understand why people were always telling me to be quiet, these kinds of things, or didn't understand what I was trying to say, or couldn't follow my line of thought. And still with my interactions with people from the U.S., I know part of it is language, but part of it is definitely communication style.
That's an interesting first introduction to Amsterdam, a city that's known for many different things, as are the Netherlands. Something that I associate Amsterdam with is in particular bikes. But in the Jewish context, I mean, there are maybe two primary figures that leap out. One maybe more traditional historical would be Baruch Spinoza. And the second one is the one that everyone knows, which is Anne Frank. How do you two, as people who live in Amsterdam, who walk its streets every day, how do you interact with its contemporary ideas of Jewish culture and community?
That's a really good question. And I think it also leads us to why we founded OIV, or Liv Nad and her brother Timur founded OIV, and we joined relatively soon after that. Because to understand Jewish life in the city, I think one first needs to understand, well, two things, actually. First of all, the rich and really amazing history of Jews in Amsterdam. Amsterdam, at a certain point, one out of every six people in Amsterdam used to be Jewish. It had a huge Jewish population. The nickname for Amsterdam, Mokum, is derived from the Hebrew word makom, which means the place, a place where Jews were welcomed, where they could thrive. And Jewish culture, Jewish language, food really became part of the city culture. And there are still some traces of that. And the other thing one needs to understand is the complete and utter destruction of the Shoah or the Holocaust. So 80 to 90% of the Dutch or the Amsterdam Jewish population was annihilated. We're looking at entire neighborhoods full of people being killed. And this has left what feels to me like a gaping wound. I think, Tori, we had some conversation. I think we have quite a similar experience that I can find myself in certain areas in the city and it feels like it's a grave tomb in a way. And then on the other hand, I also know that we are standing on the shoulders of rich and vibrant Jewish life. And I think one of the things that when OIV was founded, we realized was that what is left of Jewish life is often you know, a monument or a museum or empty houses or a synagogue, but the synagogue is heavily fortified and secured, so it's not really accessible to people. Jewish life is behind high walls, and it's something that people associate with history and with death, and that is something that we wanted to change.
That was really beautifully said, Yella. When I first came here, and still, but really when I first came here, I just felt like haunted all the time. And it still happens to me where you just feel overwhelmed with loss here. And it's really a lot of grief. And Oy Vey, like, Oy Vey started out, it was supposed to be a bakery, which is like great, a Jewish bakery. It's just what the city needs for sure. But then the COVID lockdown started and some people started finding each other in activist spaces, especially around Black Lives Matter. We eventually just became this community. We've really built a lot of community in the last few years. It's been really incredible. We realized at a certain point that if we wanted to be Jewish activists in the Netherlands, we had to have Jewish roots in the Netherlands. We had to connect with each other in a Jewish way. You just can't like spring up out of nowhere. Maybe that doesn't feel urgent enough for people who are really dedicated to activism in the political way. But for us, we realized we need to dig our roots deep. We need to plant them before we can start really going outward as much as we were at the beginning.
I think you are absolutely right that the people that are kind of the driving force behind Oy Vey, most of us, we came from this activist space. And also there was a lot going on, like the COVID lockdowns inspired a lot of conspiracy theories, anti-Semites out on the streets, white supremacists marching with their little Nazi flags and their crazy, you know, ideas about Jews. So we also,
or worse, with their yellow stars. That is the worst.
Or worse, conflating lockdown measures with the Nazi persecution of Jews, things like that. So we felt like we had to organize. There were people out on the street saying, we are Anne Frank, or there were so many different things happening all at once. So that spurred us into becoming a sort of little community of Jews that wanted to be out on the streets visibly and also in solidarity with other movements and other struggles. But right now, I would say that most of our community are definitely not activists. We have built a community, mostly, I think, of people that were looking for something that they couldn't find anywhere else in the Dutch Jewish community. And that was, you know, a Jewish space that is, on the one hand, unapologetically Jewish, but also inclusive and open, outward facing. So one of the things that we've been doing with our events is that we are often very visible. We are on the streets. We are outside. We are in buildings where also other communities meet. And that is for us very important, and really the core of what we do is that we want to be visible. We want to say, like, this is also our country and we have a rich history, even though many people maybe see us as something from the past.
Absolutely. And I think that really speaks to a sort of diasporist mode of organizing, where it's not necessarily our place to be at the forefront of any one particular movement, but asserting that we are Jews, we have roots in the places that we are, and we belong here. We are part of this rich history. And I think in a place like Amsterdam, which is similar to, I'm sure Zach's going to say a little bit about Krakow, Vienna, and different cities in Europe, which have rich Jewish histories, it's really valuable to simply be visibly Jewish again and emphasize that this isn't something of the past. And also, I think what Zach brought up with the kind of saying both Spinoza and Anne Frank as the two most well-known Jews of Amsterdam kind of speaks to something where Anne Frank ends up overshadowing what Spinoza might represent, which Spinoza, for those who might not know that much about him, came, I believe, from like a crypto-Jew Jewish background. And I mean, he was eventually excommunicated by the mainstream Jewish community in Amsterdam because they thought he was an atheist, because he was there saying that God and nature are the same thing, and emphasizing like a pantheist theology, saying that God is the universe and more. And the mainstream Jewish community was not a huge fan of that. But I think a couple hundred years later, we're able to see that actually there's like a lot of deep value in the perspective that he was bringing to his Judaism that I think a lot of more mainstream Jews in recent years have really started to grapple with and engage with in a way that is really fruitful and often deepens people's understanding of what it means to be spiritually Jewish. I was wondering if there was any way that you guys have been like connecting with that longer history, or if it's been more about just being Jewish here in the present.
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, Spinoza is kind of inescapable. And I don't think we have an overt connection, but he comes up in our chats quite often, like in our group chats. We do have a program called Deviant Yeshiva, which is run by a philosopher. So of course we discuss ideas like those of Spinoza's together. And even if that's not a public, we do it in our chats and in our private conversation. So there's a great statue of him near the memorial to the Jewish citizens who resisted. And he's covered in birds and it's just really great. I really love it. And of course, there's the Portuguese synagogue, which still exists. It's still there.
Which, by the way, has never retracted the ban. I even believe
they doubled down on it. Or the rabbi doubled down.
They doubled down on it and they banned one of their, I think, a professor who studied Spinoza also like from attending the synagogue. So this
only the rabbi. And the board wrote him a letter and said that he wanted to shoot part of a documentary on Spinoza in their library. And the rabbi wrote him and told him that he couldn't because Spinoza had been excommunicated, not only in his time, but forever. And then the board wrote him a letter and said, of course, you can come shoot a documentary here. I mean, they sell his books there.
Some things never change. For those listeners who might not know, the Jewish community in the Netherlands has a significant Sephardic history. In fact, the first Jews that were allowed back into England after the Edict of Expulsion in 1290 were Dutch Sephardic Jews. Netherlands were relatively tolerant, as I understand. That history comes up in all sorts of different places. Vladimir Medem writes in his memoirs that one of the Socialist International Congresses, I think it's 1904, that takes place in Amsterdam. He has this note on Sephardic Jewish children and the Jewish community there that he observes, which is quite interesting and easily accessible. You mentioned the bakery, which is very interesting to me because it seems to me, I've been to Amsterdam two or three times, I believe. It reminds me quite a bit of the sort of experiences that I have in Krakow and now Vienna. This is the first episode that I'm recording in Vienna. But yeah, the old Jewish past, you know, the community that's quite closed, at least depending on the community, and behind, you know, high walls and with security and such. I was wondering, you know, the Netherlands are quite a touristy destination, and in Poland, Krakow, and its Jewish quarter is one of like the main issues when we're talking about things like bakeries or libraries or other sort of amenities of help with Jewish communal life. These things, they also connect with how the outside world sees areas that used to be majority Jewish, whether it be or had much higher Jewish populations than today, places like Kazimierz or Leopoldstadt. So I'm wondering, like, how do such factors like over-tourism or housing or Airbnb, how do they impact the Jewish historical legacy?
I think Amsterdam, when it comes to mass tourism, the city has one trick up her sleeve, and that is the Anne Frank House. So most of Jewish history and former Jewish life or current Jewish life is kind of hidden from plain sight. Of course, there is the big Portuguese synagogue, which is attached to the Jewish Museum. Then there is the Holocaust Museum that's also quite close to that. So yes, there is a Jewish cultural quarter, the city calls it. So that is, I think, quite a touristy place, even though my theory is that most of the tourists visiting there are Jews. And then there is the Anne Frank House, which of course attracts millions of people. I feel like that's one of the main reasons that people visit Amsterdam, and this history of Anne Frank become a very interesting and also sometimes a bit problematic aspect, I feel. And it's also one of the reasons that I think, at least for me, led to our idea for the Jewish Manifesto that we'll talk about later, is that so much of Jewish history, or even Jews themselves, is being reduced to Anne Frank for instance, which is like one of the few very visible Jews in Dutch culture, which is a bit strange because she was a German refugee to begin with, and she died. She was killed.
Yeah, and I mean, all the Jewish neighborhoods were all torn down. So there you go. So a lot of them were just flattened.
Just to stick on the Holocaust and also the far right, as far as I understand, Geert Wilders won the elections recently. Austria is still reeling from the FPÖ victory in the parliamentary elections here, the far-right Freedom Party. I didn't prepare this exactly, and I'm also a little bit wary sometimes because in the Mexico episode, I said stuff like the PRI was founded in 1928, or they started, it was actually 1929, and then I'm not sure if it sounds good if I edit it out, or should I include it, add a note, whatever. I remember reading a study about the Netherlands, because Netherlands has both a Catholic and a Protestant majority counties, that during the Holocaust, the levels of assistance to Jews were disproportionately high in areas where there were minorities of the both religions that were significant above a certain percent. And I really would like to know, I didn't prepare this, if I can find it, I'll look into it and I'll find something in the description. And then also, during World War II, the Communist Party of the Netherlands organized a strike whilst being illegal against the persecution of Jews, which was in itself quite a unique event of its kind during the Second World War.
I just want to point out that a lot of members of the Communist Party were Jewish, and maybe they didn't consider themselves Jewish.
Especially in the religious sense,
not mm-hmm. at all, but we often talk about resistance as if Jews didn't participate in resistance here. And that is a real sore point in Dutch history, is this erasure of Jews from resistance. I think it's really important to just keep reminding ourselves the first mass deportations in Amsterdam were of the Jews who were working class and in the socialist neighborhoods.
That's mm-hmm. really interesting, not something that you always come across when it comes to discussion, like the differences in class. And what I'm trying to basically point out is that there is a legacy of the idea of safety through solidarity. You hear this as more of a motto. There's a book that came out recently. I'm afraid I don't remember the name of the author. We can use this as a good segue to talk about your group, because you mentioned the George Floyd protests as an important part of your organizing. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about, you've mentioned the ideas of beginning as a bakery, which is fascinating to me, because that's not the perspective that you see a lot of Jewish progressive diasporists coming from. In Krakow, we've started things as, we're interested in doing things as a gastronomical cooperative. So really interesting. But can you tell us a bit more about how you're structured? How do people get involved and such with Oive Amsterdam? Why choose that name?
Yella takes those questions.
I think as far as the name goes, we get a lot of questions about that. Some criticism. I think what we wanted to do is just have this kind of exclamation, this Yiddish exclamation, and, you know, have it be loud and also a little bit cliche, you know, to just immediately know what you're talking about and that this is a Jewish organization or a Jewish group. As far as structure, I would say we are not the most structured organization on the planet, but people know where to find us. We have a really vibrant community on WhatsApp, where we have like discussion groups, people organize themselves in different channels, volunteers, and also around different topics. So I feel like this really has been the main vehicle of our group, where people sort of come into the fold and then they get exposed to all the activities and all the things that we do. And next time we see them at one of our events. And that is actually another one of the structures that we have in place. We have monthly Shabbat gatherings. So that is where, you know, most people come in. People are invited also to bring, you know, a tradition of theirs or a song or a story or a poem or whatever. And we also do events around holidays. We have the reading group, the Deviant Yeshiva. There's a lot going on that people can participate in. And also, one of the main things is we have like most of the things are organized by a small core group of people, but a lot of what we do is also co-created with our community. So people that have an idea and that want to have to make that happen can come to us and usually make it happen.
Which is a great segue to the Yod's Manifest, because in a way that is a co-creation with the community. I mean, some of us put in hundreds of hours of work into it, like me and Yella, but we listened to what people had to say. And I think that's really important.
Absolutely. I think that's super important to be creating things in dialogue with the community. And I definitely want to move towards discussing this manifesto that you've created. But before that, I know that you've mentioned a little bit about the mainstream and visible Jewish community and how it's kind of, I might use the word isolationist in its sort of safety through separation rather than safety through solidarity, which I'd say is very common. The episode we did last year with Shabbos 24/7, one of our guests from that episode talked about how we see similar things in Antwerp, which is not too far from where you guys are. Before we move into the manifesto, I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the relationships your community has with the wider Jewish community in Amsterdam, because I know we have the mainstream communities, which I'm sure you're rather alienated from, but I also know like there's the community, the activist community Erev Rav in the Netherlands, that I'd be curious to know how you relate to other organizations, both aligned and non-aligned within the geography that you find yourselves in.
I think that we have an impact on the institutions because we don't try to compete with them. And I think that there was this idea, especially at the beginning, or maybe this fear that we were trying to compete or steal people away or something. There's something protective in the community, which I totally get. I mm-hmm. understand why Amsterdam's Jews or the Jews in the Netherlands have taken an isolationist position. It makes complete sense given the history of this country. But it also makes complete sense to start kind of questioning it and changing it, which is what we have done with the Yod's Manifest and with, or the Jewish Manifesto and with Oy Vey. What we see is that a lot of, I would say, members of Oy Vey are engaging with the institutions now as well. So more and more are going to services, let's say, and doing the religious things that we don't offer. So in fact, they should be embracing us and so excited about our presence and just happy that we're here and also happy that we're giving, especially that people between children and adults, you know, where a lot of Jewish institutions just abandon you. So here we are in the middle making this space where people can be really Jewish.
I mean, on the safety and solidarity point, that sort of kickstarted Oy Vey, because we felt that our communities were so detached in some ways from the struggles of other minorities, mostly in this country. When the protests erupted around the murder of George Floyd, also here, there were huge protests in Amsterdam. Really, our organizing started from the fact that we noticed that our community leaders were completely silent. And for this, I don't think we should forgive them, per se, but I do want to say that I have a deep empathy for the way that our communities are. Because when we talk about safety in solidarity, there was some safety in solidarity during the Holocaust, I would say. Like there were cases of people being saved by their Christian neighbors, especially a lot of Christians and communists who were involved in resistance work and in people going into hiding and things like that. But we also know that the Netherlands had a huge amount of collaboration. And not only from institutions, a lot from institutions, but also from individuals, from neighbors, that when people came back after the Holocaust from the camps or from hiding, their houses had been taken. They were, you know, told that they had to pay taxes. They were told that they had to pay rent. They were told to shut up about what had happened to them. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that I have a lot of empathy for this attitude. And this is interesting. I think we are at a point, not all of them, but a lot of the people behind Oy Vey are from a generation of Jewish people that maybe can a bit more easily leave behind this heritage of trauma and also explore and have fun and reconnect with their heritage. And I'm also really happy that a group like Erev Rav has come into existence. I think this is really important for a pluralistic and diverse ecosystem of Jewish groups and organizations as it once used to be in the Netherlands.
Totally agree.
I had a quick Google search. I believe that the article that I heard someone else reference is Religious Minorities and Resistance to Genocide, the Collective Rescue of Jews in the Netherlands During the Holocaust by Robert Braun or Brown from the American Political Science Review. It talks about the disproportionality of rescue attempts for Jews where minority churches were in the Netherlands during the Holocaust. We'll leave a link in the description, of course.
That's fascinating.
Tori, what you said was really, really resonant with my own experience here in Santa Cruz on the other side of the world, because there are groups that are emerging that are on a surface level, perhaps in contradiction with the existing mainstream institutions, but in a real way, serve people that these institutions just can't serve or are unwilling to serve. And I think it's really fascinating how your group has managed to be kind of like a way that people can plug back into their Judaism, which then serves the mainstream institutions. Because if people are plugged into their Judaism in a way that is on their own terms and is in alignment with their values, and then that serves the mainstream institutions by actually bringing them back in. And like, I'm kind of in like a strange position where I'm both working with and engaging with the outside institutions, the outside groups that are arguably like pitted against the mainstream institutions. But I'm also, I mean, I'm literally sitting within the Reform Shul that I grew up in and work in. So like, these don't need to be seen as in opposition to one another. And I think it's really important for us to see that like, by building outside, we are actually playing a stronger role in pushing these institutions into alignment with our values in a way that otherwise, they're just not going to change. I mean, it has to be seen that if they want to, especially like from that age group, early 20s to mid 40s until you have children or whatever, like these are people that are alienated or just don't feel like there is programs that are interesting or made for them in particular. And it's really valuable to have these outside groups that, I mean, I've found are mostly people in their 20s and 30s, which is the particular demographic that the mainstream institutions really struggle to actually attract.
Can I add just one thing? I heard something beautiful from Rabbi Donya Rutenberg. She said that a synagogue is like a community of communities. And that I feel is like what Oy Vey is, a community of communities. We're not a synagogue, but we do contain lots of different kinds of Jews and kinds of Jewish ideas within our community. We talked to people a few weeks ago when we were creating a crowdfunding video about what they felt was missing in Jewish life here. And it didn't make it into the crowdfunding video, but I just want to say that several people said this kind of community of disagreement. There's that Talmudic idea that there's disagreement for the sake of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that that was missing in Dutch life. And I thought that was really, really important to bring up. And I really feel that at Oy Vey, we've tried very hard to find a path that's clear, a political stance that's clear. But the more that we build our community, the more I think we see that we're holding this space of disagreement in a really beautiful way. And I hope we can continue to hold it.
I think the emerging diasporist Jewish movement is quite significant because it is post-denominational. It isn't just Reform Jews. It's not just Orthodox Jews. It is bringing together all these different kinds of Jews that have different relationships to halakha and whatnot and different minhag traditions. And they come together on shared values. And I think there's real power in that. And I think this upcoming year that we're beginning right now is going to be a year of massive growth and institutionalization, hopefully, and building out this network and this movement that can actually start to shift the communal conversation in a really important way. And I really do want to move towards your manifesto because I think it does play a particular role within that.
I think it's one of the most important things that we need to accentuate when it comes to involving mainstream communal institutions is this like point of democracy and possibility of like diversity of opinion that's considered constructive and not destructive. To pretend that all Jews like agree on things in general, on everything, in the same way that if this was the way in which we talked about Polish people or Dutch people or Arabs or whatever, like this would be considered like weirdly nationalistic, tribalistic stuff. But when it comes to like debate and open like democracy within Jewish communal institutions, this is often considered like, why is this seemed as important, or where organizations that actually do claim to be democratic aren't really. And likewise, on the other hand, divisions are important if they are about important things. But if you look at some communities, if you look at like Krakow is a good example of this. And the problem is in Krakow is that a lot of the divisions are about nonsense, like actual nonsense, infighting, gossip, petty drama, wounded egos, etc. And then in those situations, I think it's also worth for there to be people who are like in groups and movements who are ideologically committed to certain things or politically committed to certain things and say, these divisions are nonsense. get it together, yeah. Right? There are important places for where divisions can take place, but there are also places where you need to work together if there is like good positive consequences on that. So yes, there's a lot of movement on different things we don't want to talk about.
Can I jump on that? There's one thing that I really think, I do feel that it's important to note this at this specific time in history, because our institutions are playing a very problematic role in this moment when we're seeing the genocide that's unfolding in Gaza and we're seeing all the horrors that are being committed out of the name of Judaism. And I was at, you know, my large Reform community during the high holidays, and I was baffled by the speeches that were given from the Bima that sort of created this atmosphere as if we were all firmly behind what is being done or what is happening in Israel right now. And I think that this is extremely dangerous. And this is one of the things that I think within Oyvei we are trying to hold. We are trying to contain different perspectives and discussions whilst very strongly also based in a certain progressive values, let's say. So no, there is no room for genocide apologetics, let's say. And also the reason that a group like Erev Rav has sprung into existence, because our mainstream institutions have failed us and are trying to actively erase dissent and division from their spaces. And that's extremely worrying and extremely sad.
Mm-hmm. It's quite clear when it comes to like what the situation is in the United States. We know what the opinion polling is. We know what Jews, especially young Jews, think on apartheid and what the Israeli government is doing. And even, I mean, like right now, I just saw an opinion poll a few days ago from the Times of Israel that like 73% of Israelis want a ceasefire for hostages. And just to people are still stuck as if it's October 7th, 2023. And in a lot of places, the discourse just hasn't changed, even though like we know what has been going on for the last year. When it comes to the manifesto, because Ben says there's a lot of that are going on, and I'm sure as well the next year will be a big year of growth for anything, and institutional growth is a bit like of a, sometimes people worry when they hear institution. I like the word structure, because in some sense even a lack of structure is structure in itself. But certainly, you know, yeah, very postmodernist, I guess. But in terms of your manifesto, you're going to be releasing it very soon, a few days after this podcast will the shelves of Spotify and Apple Podcasts, I guess. Can you like tell us just a little bit about the new Jewish manifesto, the Hetyords Manifest, if I'm pronouncing that somewhat correctly? And yes, good. Oh, thank you. That means a lot. So how did you sort of work on it? And you talked a little bit about your process, but it's interesting to see how, you know, these documents get synthesized. And I don't know as well how it connects. I don't know if you've had any look at, for example, the Declaration of Independence of Diaspora that the group in Prague, another European group. The reason I mentioned America earlier is because when it comes to polling, opinion polling within the Jewish community, that's something that's more visible in America with the largest size. And because there's not so much polling done on Jewish communities in Europe, it's rarer and less accurate, I would argue as well. Because there's no polling, that means that people don't have differences of opinion. It gets to mask it in that way. Coming back to what I was saying earlier, how have you been working on this? And can you tell us a little bit about what we can expect?
Since Yella was in from the very beginning, I think I definitely talk about how it started, which I can't do. But when I came in, we decided to start holding conversations with Jews in the Netherlands around certain topics. And for 2 years, we had monthly conversations face-to-face and online around different topics. Most of them were completed before October 7th, 2023. And the conversations that were left, well, one of them was our conversation on Israel, which we hadn't spoken about yet. But these conversations were quite intimate. I want to back up a bit because as an American Jew, I am super confident in my Jewish identity. Like, I feel Jewish. Nobody can tell me I'm not Jewish. Like, people could excommunicate me and I would just laugh in their face. I mean, nothing would hit me because I am, to my core, a very Jewish person. I just was born this way, as they say. There's never a moment in my life when I could think I'm not Jewish. This kind of, I would call it almost an arrogance about my Jewish identity, made me very demanding about the Jewish community in the Netherlands. So these kinds of conversations we had were people opened up and they shared their family stories and their backgrounds, and this kind of brokenness in the community touched me really deeply. And it was such a humbling experience, and it really changed me. It changed what I expected from the Jewish community, and it just changed the way that I interacted. And also it made me more comfortable here. I felt like it allowed me to become part of the Jewish community. This is what I'd say that the Jewish Manifesto for me, just working on it, has been life-changing. And I'm old, so changing my life is like a constant thing for me. I hope this document that we've created won't be the end of it, but we'll keep connecting and changing people's lives. And there's a point in the document where we actually say that we look forward to the time when people come up and challenge us. So important to remember that being Jewish is this process. The reason that we've been around for so long is because of this kind of challenge, this ability to challenge, this ability to change, this ability to absorb, and this ability to allow new people to become citizens of our tribe. I really think that this kind of interaction, this kind of challenge and disagreement and reconnection and connection is really crucial to Jewish life and Jewish life here.
Tori, I do know you have to go, so I don't want to hold you much longer. But I was wondering if you could say a little bit, just from your own experience, what the American Jewish perspective contributed to this process of creating this manifesto and how your own experience differed from those in the Netherlands. I know you said a little bit on this, just because a lot of our audience is American, and I think this is something that a lot of people might find interesting.
I think, like, I can really tell you because now I've had so much time to reflect on it, and it's reflected back to me in what people have told me. But one thing is, my family is pretty happy and joyous and joyously Jewish, even in small towns, right? Mm-hmm. And also not like wed to any denomination. So we're also kind of trans-denominational as well as filled with trans people. So we have both of these things. In one conversation, somebody told me that she had never encountered a Jewish person who had a happy family before. Hmm. And I didn't realize that this was so rare. And then she told me that when you talk about your family, and it makes me realize that it's possible to be happy, to be Jewish, to have good connections with people. And it really, really hit home how traumatized Jewish community is here in Europe, how that trauma really prevents connection, prevents joy. It's so difficult to overcome. And also for me to have this uninterrupted connection to Jewishness. I mean, I don't have an uninterrupted connection to every tradition ever, or even the language my grandparents even spoke, but I do have an uninterrupted connection to that kind of core of Jewish identity, of feeling Jewish, of practicing, of lighting candles on Friday nights, of being confident and happy. And I feel like that's something that I could bring to the project that no one else could bring to the project. And it's not that I'm like so special. It's just this one special thing that I could bring is that this imagination of being joyful and of being open and of being public that other people were still struggling with and couldn't imagine.
Absolutely. No, I hadn't thought about that, but that really resonates with my own experience. Like, my brother, who in episode 11, he interviewed a guy named Tzion, who is Ugandan, part of the Abiyudaya Jewish community. And
I love that guy.
Yeah, it was a great episode. And he told me that when Tzion came to URJ Camp Newman, which we recently released an episode about, it was the first time he'd experienced something similar to that, where, like, at the camp, we'll often go up to this top of this hill that has a Jewish star on it. And like it's kind of camp tradition to yell, "I love being Jewish," at the top of your lungs. And Sion had said like that was the first time he'd even thought that that's something that people would consider doing, of yelling that, like, "I love being Jewish," and emphasizing that role that joy and happiness plays in the Jewish experience. And it's not something that we really think about as necessarily, it's not something that's exclusive to the American Jewish experience. But I think there is something to be said about the relative lack of trauma that we've experienced in our corner of the diaspora that definitely does play a role in the amount of like optimism, like we could call it Judeo-optimism, that we might have from our own experience. I mean, my own family history, like I definitely don't have any close family ancestors that perished in the Shoah. So I do have probably less generational trauma than like 95% of Jews. I sometimes wonder what role that plays in like my own outlook. And I think there's value in being able to bring that perspective to a place like the Netherlands, to places that have more lived recent trauma in their own communal memory. And I think it's also important to have those dialogues and ground them in the communities and recognize that like not all of us are going to be as trauma-free, and there is real lived trauma that's really important to engage with, but to not get lost in it and not lose hope and sink into that Judeo-pessimism. Thank you so much for joining us, Tori.
Thank you. It was really lovely to talk to you. And I'm really glad that Yella can stay.
Thank you, Tori.
Bye.
Bye. I was actually thinking that it might be nice at the end of this, for the very first time, you know, read a little part of the manifesto out loud and like as Please. A little preview for people to, it feels like the time is right to do that. And to share some of what we've written.
This is a Jewish diasporist exclusive.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yella, could you say a little bit about that experience of creating the Jewish Manifesto? I know you said it was very communal, and like I'd love to hear from your experience the start and the general process in which it was created.
Yes. The Manifesto was basically started for, I think, two different reasons. One of them was that a very cool and important document came out that was called the Black Manifesto, or Zwart Manifest in Dutch. And this was created by an organization of Black people here in the Netherlands. And they had conversations with, I think, around 5,000 members of Black communities here in the Netherlands. And they created a document that is very different from ours. It's much more of a policy piece, I would say, like, or like a manifesto in a more classical sense. So they have demands, and like it's about housing and education and socioeconomic circumstances and things like that. That was really an inspiration for this project. Not in a way that we thought we can do the same or there's the same need for it. It's very different like to what they did. But we did think it was important to kind of give a voice to Jews in the Netherlands and Dutch Jews. And that was because like the basic premise of the manifesto was and still is that Jews in the Netherlands, in the public discourse and in like, you know, the imagination of people and the way that Jews are being talked about, I'm sure this is recognizable, you know, at least to you, Zach, I'm not really sure how this is in the US, is that, you know, Jews are being reduced to two, maybe three, usually quite abstract and also controversial and kind of hard to talk about things. So it's either the Holocaust and Frank or Israel-Palestine, and really specific for the Dutch context, football hooligans, which I will not get into.
Ajax, right.
Yeah, and we wanted to have Jews talk about themselves and talk about their lives, their experiences, their hopes, their dreams, their fears. So that's what we set out to do. And at first we said we want to talk to, let's say, 300 Dutch Jews. The community here is fairly small. I think we managed to speak to that number of people. And what was very interesting is that we, at least for me, like a big realization during this whole process, about 2 years, I think, of, you know, having these conversations with groups of people so people could sign up for a conversation about a specific topic. And then they would come either to, you know, our space, but we also did online sessions so that people from all over the country could join. And at first, I was really focused on the end result. I was like, okay, we need to have these conversations. We need to hear what people think. We need to write it down. We need to record it. And then we're gonna, you know, boil it down into this thing that's gonna give a voice to the experience and the lived experiences of all these people somehow. And throughout the process, I really started to realize that a lot of this was about community building, because people came back. They came sometimes twice or to three different sessions. People expressed also to us, like, this was so special to me, so important to me. I remember people saying things like, I've never met other Jews. I've never talked to other Jews about the experience of being a Jew or my own personal experience and their experience. So, you know, this was a really special and I think really important process for us, but also for many of the participants. And I will say, one of the things we did, we created this kind of flow chart. Like, it started as a bit of a joke, but where we said, are you Jewish enough to participate? And then we, you know, said things like, only my father is Jewish. And then it would lead to, you're Jewish enough. Or, I don't know other Jews. No, you're Jewish enough. I ate pork yesterday. You're Jewish enough. So we really like lowered the threshold for people to come, because I think that also came from, at least also from my personal experience of being gatekept and being questioned at the door of Jewish institutions and being, you know, treated with suspicion. And we really wanted to be welcoming and open to also to really be a space where people that don't go to the institutions, that aren't a member of the synagogues, to have those people participate and tell us about their lives.
Yella, would you be so kind to show us a little bit of a teaser trailer for the manifesto?
So I will read to you, this is really exclusive, we haven't shared this with anybody else yet. So I will read just the first couple of sentences of the manifesto. We are shattered and whole. We are Jews in the Netherlands, people from all over the world who found a refuge here. Some of us made a home here last year, and others have lived here for hundreds of years. We come bearing gifts of language, stories, food, and culture. We are the descendants of those who survived the Shoah and the Inquisition and all manners of violence, expulsions, and persecutions. You may recognize our legacies in the words that you use, the food you eat, the occasional smattering of Hebrew letters carved into stone on the side of a building. You may stumble over the names of our ancestors and predecessors commemorated in sidewalk markers. I'm going to stop.
No, please don't. It's beautiful. It's really, really nice.
I can continue.
It's very beautifully written.
I'm really happy with the way it's turned out. There's an English translation, a Dutch translation. We're also recording the whole thing. So,
what is your plan for releasing it, publicizing it? Where do you see it going?
I mean, first of all, we're going to release it with a big event. We're calling it the Jewish Manifestival in a couple of weeks. And yeah, this is really where we want to sort of gift the manifesto to our community and also to the people that participated, because it's also their manifesto. And also, I mean, we've been doing this and there's some other events and occasions planned where we also want to introduce other, not necessarily Jewish communities, but thus far it has mostly been Jewish communities, to this idea of doing this and the methodology that we used to make it. And there's one thing that we haven't really talked about how we're going to do it, but I personally would really love to not only share this manifesto with, you know, other minorities or other communities in the Netherlands, but also with politicians, with leaders, but also with our own institutions. Because I think something that really shines through the manifesto in a lot of ways is that people are reaching for a connection to their Judaism and a connection that in many cases has been broken or fractured, and many people are afraid to reconnect with their Judaism, and the institutions play a big part in this. So, you know, I have this fantasy of like printing it out and like hammering it with a nail.
Like Martin Luther.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
But also, like, at least invite, you know, the leaders of our institutions to read it, because I think they can learn a lot from it.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's giving me all different kinds of ideas in terms of maybe just compiling. If this is one of several documents, the one that we're most acquainted of is in Prague, but there are other articulations and modern ideas of what diasporism means. And I think that bringing in, you know, different perspectives from around the world, especially places like Czech Republic and the Netherlands, which in the English language dominated Jewish diaspora consciousness, is very important.
Maybe one last thing is that I also really hope that this manifesto somehow contributes to sort of breaking through what is expected of us as Jews. I really feel like as Jews in the societies that we live in, or at least I can only speak for the Dutch society, we are expected to play a certain role. And we are expected to only talk about certain things, to look a certain way, to act a certain way, to believe certain things, to be affiliated to certain nation states, things like that. And I think the manifesto really shows that our community is diverse, holds a lot of perspectives and a lot of things that you might not expect, a lot of deviancy. That's, I hope, what will be a main takeaway for a lot of people.
I don't mean to completely screw up a nice little tying a bow on the end there, but there is just like the reality of current politics in the Netherlands. I know Geert Wilders, I believe is how his name is pronounced, is not fully ascendant, but there is a rising far right in the Netherlands that I've seen some of his stuff. He's like very supportive of Israel in their ongoing genocide. And I think what the work you're doing does is it really kind of, as you said, kind of subverts the expectations that someone like that places on the Jewish community. And just to kind of close, perhaps, I was wondering how your organization is challenging that and what connections you're building to perhaps move us away from that reality. I know Europe in general is kind of moving to the far right in terms of anti-immigration sentiment, especially. But I was kind of wondering if you're building connections with other similar organizations in other parts of Europe and around the world. And what's your dream? What do you see as like the ideal next few years of where this work could lead? And what are you doing to lead us towards that future?
There's so many possible directions that this all could go in. And some of them to me seem very bleak and very dark. So I feel like at least we are, with the work that we're doing, and not only with the manifesto, but also in speaking out against the way that anti-Semitism is being weaponized by the far right, anti-Semitism is reduced to super specific, palatable forms, or like...
Yeah, I mean, the conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism is very dangerous, and we do see that instrumentalized by the far right.
It's disgusting. And then again, what we're also seeing right now is that the far right is basically saying that anti-Semitism is an important issue, that it's migrants, of course, mostly Muslim migrants, that bring anti-Semitism into this society. And I think one of the things that we are doing and that we will continue to do is scream from the top of our lungs that you cannot pit different minorities against each other like that, because it will make none of us safer in the end. And it also kind of cynically abuses history to say, like, this is a country that was free of anti-Semitism until George Soros started bringing all these migrants in, which, by the way, is an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. So, you know, the far right is making all these ridiculous tumbles and turns, and we are there to kind of stick a stick into their wheel sometimes and try to make a dent into this discourse. Yeah, as far as connections with other organizations, we have connections with Jewish groups and organizations all over Europe. We've just published the Ma'agal, Radical Jewish Calendar, together with Paideia and also some other groups and organizations. We're doing the Kollel program, which is like Talmud study, but in a cool way, with Hillel Deutschland and, you know, some other partners there, Paideia. We are building networks, and hopefully we can sustain them in the future. And yeah, but for us, it's really about building vibrant, positive Jewish life in the diaspora, I'm also to say we are here and we're not going anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, it just reminded me of like the recent announcement over the last couple of months of the European Jews for Palestine network that was emerged with some similar groups, and kind of makes me wonder, like, yes, that is related to the work we're doing, but it's not exactly the work we're doing as diasporists. And I'm like wondering if there is going to be a, I mean, it's not like they're wholly exclusive, but like a more explicitly positive vision focused version of that, of a network that's focused on the Jewish struggle, because it's not just about us being in solidarity with Palestinians. It's about us fighting for our own communities and obviously for the idea of safety through solidarity and rooting ourselves in the places that we are, wherever we are.
To say one last thing about this, I think this moment in history where, you know, it's really a crisis also of Judaism. It's really a crisis when so many people are saying, this is Judaism. Killing 17,000 children is Judaism. Building settlements in Gaza potentially is Judaism. This is really going to create a huge rift. It's already creating a huge rift in Jewish community. And I think it's super important that initiatives like European Jews for Palestine, but I also think to add to that is that we do need to answer this question of what does the future of Jewish life in Europe and everywhere else in the world, what does it look like beyond the genocidal apartheid state of Israel, which unfortunately so many Jews and so many other people, non-Jews, seem to see Judaism and Israel as interlinked. And I think we need to challenge that at every possible turn.
Absolutely. And I mean, from the get-go of doing this podcast, part of the goal has been to create and foster and to help build up the network that can speak for ourselves and say that we are not Israel. Israel does not have the right to claim exclusive monopoly over Jewish self-determination on the global stage. It's important for us to demand our own right to speak for ourselves wherever we live and to challenge the way that this is instrumentalized by the far right for their own ends, because that doesn't protect us. It actually just puts us into greater danger. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been a really wonderful conversation, and I'm sorry for throwing a wrench into that nice, neat conclusion that Zach had in mind. But I think it was important for us to touch on those last little things.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It was really great to be on, and I love the work that you're doing. So
we are beautiful people, though our hearts are broken. We sing for justice and we are beautiful people.